Thanks very much, and thanks everyone for coming. I didn't plan on my recent trip to be covering another war. I was just going to go to Syria, and the day I landed was the day that Hezbollah carried out their operation and it all kicked off. So I want to leave. I was invited to talk about Iraq, and that's what I'm going to do for the next 50 minutes, but I want to leave about 25 minutes at the end for Q&A so that then you can take this where you want it to go as far as into Lebanon or Syria or whatever. But I want to talk to you in the first 50 minutes here strictly about Iraq. And what I'm going to really focus on is just the propaganda around that war and really the underlying causes as far as what is U.S. policy in Iraq. It's something that really doesn't get much, if any at all, media coverage by the corporate media. And I want to start with quoting, well, first of all, how many people in here saw the documentary Control Room about Al Jazeera? Okay, then you probably will remember the senior producer of Al Jazeera at the very beginning of that documentary, Samir Khadr, when he's looking into the camera and he says, "You cannot wage a war without rumors, without media, without propaganda. Any military planner who plans for a war, if he doesn't put media or propaganda on top of his agenda, he's a bad military." The next person I want to quote is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Peter Pace, highest-ranking member of the U.S. military in this country. And on March the 5th, on Meet the Press, he was being interviewed by Tim Russert. And Tim Russert asked him, "General Pace, how exactly are things going in Iraq?" And he said, quote, "I'd say they're going well. I wouldn't put a great big smiley face on it, but I would say they're going very, very well from everything you look at." So he's not a bad military, according to Samir Khadr. This is clearly a good military, a very good propagandist, and a very good liar. And so to give an update of what very, very well looks like in Iraq, I want to start with two friends of mine from Iraq, one from Baghdad and one from Bakuba, two men that I'm very close with. One is Abu Talat, my interpreter that I've worked with since almost the beginning in Iraq. And another is a friend of mine, a sheikh from Bakuba, who came out to meet me. And I want to start with Bakuba. They're both currently preparing to leave the country, doing everything they can to leave. And my friend from Bakuba, he is trying to get a job in the Kurdish north because it is much more secure there. Because in Bakuba, he said, every day there's fighting, every day there's death. We don't know. One day the U.S. military might have control of the city. The next day, a certain resistance group might have control of it. The next day, a militia might have control of it. The next day, maybe it's a few criminal gangs that banded together and took control of it. He said, that's the situation now in Bakuba, that there's so much fighting and so much death that I just want to leave. And he's married and he has a few little children. And then in Baghdad, my interpreter, Abu Talat, he's one of these people that about a year ago, I was in Amman, Jordan, covering the situation from there. And I asked him, I was basically trying to convince him to leave Baghdad. I said, look, look at it now compared to a year ago. It's getting so much worse. You really just need to leave. It's very clear that civil war is going to happen. When are you going to go? And I was doing everything I could to convince him to leave. And he said, well, you know, Dar, my heart is in Baghdad. I could never leave Baghdad. And you know, he's a diehard. And, you know, those of us who have been to Baghdad know that there's an allure and it's a very special place. And he clearly didn't want to leave. And I said, okay, well, I did what I could to convince him, and he's going to stay. Flash forward to right now, when we were just together in Damascus a few days ago, and he's leaving. He's desperately trying to find a way to get his young sons out. Can they go to Amman? No, because Jordan is now not letting in military-age males. Basically means anyone between 18 and 50 years old is literally turned around at the border of Jordan and sent back to Baghdad. They just won't let them in because of terrorism, I suppose. And so he's trying to find a way to get his boys out. He's trying to find a way to get his wife out. Where can she work? Where can they live where the government will allow that? Because having an Iraqi passport now is kind of the kiss of death. You can basically go to Jordan if you're lucky, or Syria, and that's about it. So that's what very, very well looks like from just two personal friends of mine in Iraq. People are leaving. Everyone who can in any way afford to leave financially, or if they have a job, or even just some other place they can go, they're leaving Iraq as quickly as possible. Why is this exodus happening? First, I think the most important statistic I can ever talk about regarding Iraq is the fact that well over 100,000 Iraqis have been killed as a direct result of the invasion and occupation. And my citation for this is the Lancet report, report that was published in the most prestigious medical journal in the UK. And when it was published, it stated 98,000 excess deaths in Iraq as a result of the invasion and occupation. And I argue that that statistic is too low, along with one of the co-authors, Les Roberts. And it's too low for three main reasons. One, it was released on October 29, 2004. So it's grossly out of date. And then if we just look at the last 6 months alone in Iraq, it's just been a blood fest. The blood is flowing. Scores of people every single day are dying. This last month alone, at least 1,500 people died in Baghdad alone. The previous months before that were, I believe, 3,000 each month in Baghdad alone. So the date factor of 98,000 is far too low. And then in February, this past February, Les Roberts, one of the co-authors, came out and said, we need to be talking not whether it was, because there was a big argument with his statistics compared with Iraq body count, which only reports deaths reported by the Western media or media with an English website. So it's a very incomplete statistic. And he said, Les Roberts from the Lancet said, we need to be talking not if it's 20 or 30,000 who have been killed in Iraq, because at the time that's what Iraq body count was reporting. He said, we need to be talking about, is it 200 or 300,000? Because the Lancet report intentionally did not include areas of major combat operations so as not to skew the survey. So they didn't include the Fallujahs, they didn't include the Najafs, they didn't include the Al-Qaims, any of that kind of stuff. So it's without a doubt 100,000 is a ridiculously low statistic. I think we need to be talking about, is it 250,000 or is it 300,000, or at this point is it starting to push 400,000? And then we look at the number of U.S. soldiers killed, which I think is also underreported. The current statistic is now well over 2,500, if not over 2,600 by now. And I say that that's too low because it doesn't include green card soldiers, which I'm sure many people in this room are aware of, that if someone, for example, from El Salvador wants U.S. citizenship, one way they can do it is join the military, where they're promised when they complete serving their tour, then they'll get a green card. Well, if those people are killed in Iraq, the DOD doesn't have to report that because they're not a U.S. citizen. Similarly, mercenaries who are killed in Iraq, while the DOD, of course, isn't required to report that either, hundreds of mercenaries have been killed in Iraq. Another important statistic is wounded soldiers. DOD, I think, is reporting something along the lines of roughly maybe 18,000. But I think we need to be, when we look at PTSD and other types of wounds, and the true number even of wounded is probably upwards of around 40 or 50,000. Already from this Iraq war alone, there's over 550,000 veterans from this war alone. The VA, if you look at Bush's plan for the VA, the next 2 years, he has these slight incremental increases, but over the next 5 years, their budget for the VA is to cut $10 billion. So that's how Bush supports the troops that are coming home, either supporting their dead, the family members of the dead soldiers, or those who come home with no legs or massive psychological trauma, or they're suicidal. He cuts the VA. the man who never served himself. And now I want to talk a little bit briefly about the infrastructure in Iraq. It's something, you know, now, and myself, is I'm guilty as well as covering Lebanon and what's happening there, and not covering Iraq. I wish I had more time to cover both, but the situation, as dire as it is in southern Lebanon, is still really covering up the greater tragedy of Iraq, and that is that now, well into the fourth year of the occupation, electricity, the average home in all of Iraq, not just in Baghdad and places in the south where we know the infrastructure is in shambles, but even including in the Kurdish north, which the corporate media likes to paint as kind of the happy Kurds, they support the U.S. Well, the average home anywhere in Iraq has 3 hours of electricity per day. That's not structured. Maybe it's going to come on from 1 to 4 a.m. Maybe it's going to come on from 1 to 4 p.m. Maybe it's going to be 10 minutes here, 30 minutes there. Completely unstructured. Nobody can rely on any electricity whatsoever. Water. I want to talk about a trip that I made back in January 2004, south of Baghdad. And I did this trip because I was hired by a group called Public Citizen, a watchdog group out of D.C., to do a report on how is Bechtel progressing with their portion of their contract regarding the water infrastructure, because it was their responsibility to go in and rehabilitate and do reconstruction on some of these water treatment plants. And so I had a contract. Public Citizen got me a copy of their contract, Bechtel's contract. And it's a really vague, big surprise, vague contract. It's hard to find places that they name where they're going to go do the work, completion dates. But I did find three, and they were the water treatment plants in Hilla, Najaf, and Diwaniya, all three cities south of Baghdad. And I went to each of these, and the best, I talked with either the lead engineer or the assistant engineer at both, at all the places. And the best case scenario is one of the engineers said, yeah, some people from Bechtel came by, and some of their subcontractors switched out our sand filters, but that doesn't, in effect, produce any more potable water. It was kind of a cosmetic thing. And then the other two places that I interviewed the engineers at the water treatment plants, they basically said, Bechtel who? And what that looked like on the ground was that at a small village outside of Najaf that was still part of Najaf's water treatment infrastructure, they had a dirt hole in the ground about that deep. Whenever the electricity ran for any of those 3 hours, that hole would fill with water. They dug the hole to get down to a pipe they found where water would still go through. They punched a hole in it so that when the electricity ran, the water would fill up the hole. It's literally a dirt hole with garbage in it. And then people were there, would go and scoop water out and take home. Eight children had been killed passing a nearby freeway to a factory across the road who were giving them buckets of water to take home. Their other water source was a dirty stream about a kilometer away that they would take donkeys down with leather bags on to fill up with water. So that's what it looked like on the ground when Bechtel wasn't fulfilling their obligations. Cholera was rampant, waterborne diseases, diarrhea, kidney stones, nausea, rampant everywhere we went. In 3 days, we interviewed hundreds of people. All of them were sick. All of their kids were sick. They just wanted water. I mean, can you imagine living in the desert where at times in the summer it gets up to 140 degrees, there's no water and there's no electricity? How do you eat? How do you keep food for the next day in your refrigerator with no electricity? What do you drink? You're too poor. There's no jobs. You don't have a car. What do? These people are literally dying as a result of Bechtel not fulfilling their contractual obligations. The healthcare situation is, of course, a total disaster in Iraq, where during the 80s, before the Iran-Iraq war really started to take its toll, Iraq undoubtedly had the best medical system in the entire Middle East. They sent their doctors overseas to study in Europe and over here in some of the finest universities to come home so that they had state-of-the-art technology. It was a socialized healthcare system. Anyone could go in anytime and get anything that they needed. That has been reduced to a point after the 91 war and the 13 years of genocidal sanctions, and then this invasion and occupation. The healthcare system now looks like, one statistic from Iraqi doctors that they released about half a year ago, and things have degraded since then, said that of everyone that goes into hospitals now in Iraq, 80% leave with an infectious disease they did not have when they entered that hospital. They can't keep doctors there because kidnapping is so rampant. 30 people a day, Iraqis a day, are kidnapped in their own country because that's become the crime of choice, because they can extort money from their families. So professionals are at very great risk because, of course, doctors are prime targets. So most of the professionals have left. It's so bad that I just learned that now if you're a medical student in Iraq, or an engineer or any other professional, and you finish your studies, you're not awarded your certificate for 2 years. You have to work in Iraq for 2 years, and then they'll give you your certificate. So that's how desperate the government is to try to keep some of the professional class within the country, because otherwise they're just all going away, running for their lives, literally. So you can imagine the healthcare situation. And another thing that it's easy to forget about is, I'm sure most people in this room understand how horrific the sanctions were in Iraq, where entire hospitals couldn't even give an aspirin to someone for pain relief. They didn't have gauze. They didn't have rubber gloves. Well, those sanctions didn't end before this invasion started. And nothing has changed in those hospitals since the occupation except to get worse. And that's a point that I really can't impress home hard enough, that people understand that that's how bad things are in Iraq. This is after the sanctions, where the invasion brought no relief whatsoever. So again, I like, after talking about all this information, to repeat General Peter Pace when asked how things were going. "I'd say they are going well. I wouldn't put a great big smiley face on it, but I would say they're going very, very well from everything you look at." I want to talk some now about media complicity in the situation in Iraq, because without a doubt, this administration and the one before it, including the Clinton administration, could not have gotten away with what they've done and are doing in Iraq without a complicit media here in the U.S. In February of 2005, just after I came out of Iraq, my last trip, I was invited to a World Tribunal meeting in Rome, Italy, on media complicity. The World Tribunals are basically grassroots organized meetings that they took place in 20 different cities around the world, focusing on different aspects of the occupation and invasion, so that hopefully one day there'll be war crimes trials, and that way all this information from all of these different aspects will be on record. And this particular tribunal was on the media. Most of these are without a doubt complicit in this situation in Iraq. And what I learned at that tribunal is that after the Nuremberg trials, where the Hitler regime, what was left of it, was trialed and brought to justice for their war crimes, the Nuremberg tribunals left a precedent for journalism. In addition, UNESCO from the UN also has a standard of journalism, and both UNESCO and that set after the Nuremberg trials states that in the time of war, the primary responsibility for all media is not to incite the public to violence. And, you know, when we look up on this banner and see, okay, the New York Times, the so-called newspaper of note, Judith Miller, Thomas Friedman, cheerleaders for war, everything they wrote has now been proven false without a doubt. Anyone with a pulse can see that. This paper, institutions like NPR, some of their reporting where they've literally been found using State Department spokespeople and people for Voice of America, American propaganda radio in other countries, interviewing them on NPR. This is what this is the best that our so-called free media can do regarding in Iraq. And without a doubt, when we hold that type of coverage up to the even just this basic principle in the Nuremberg principles in UNESCO of not to incite the public for violence. That's exactly what most of these outlets up here are without a doubt guilty of doing, and without a doubt should be held, brought to trial for aiding and abetting in all of the war crimes that have taken place inside of Iraq and continue to take place. They allowed that to happen and greatly facilitated it. And now with their silence, continue to aid and abet in the total destruction of what's left of Iraq at this point. I want to talk now about U.S. plans in Iraq, and I want to give you a brief overview of what it looks like, because Bush, of course, already a ways back said, well, he'd be leaving this situation for some future president to take care of. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean even the next U.S. president, because there's no talk of withdrawal from the Cheney administration, because there are no plans for U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. And I want to start by talking about the so-called U.S. embassy that is being built as we speak right now inside the Green Zone in central Baghdad. This embassy, the contract for it was awarded to a very corrupt Kuwaiti company for $592 million. When you think about embassy, when I do, I always would think that it's kind of like a smallish, maybe two or three story white building. They have a gardener, they have a cook. You lose your passport, you go there and you get another passport, or you know, you get new pages added into your passport if you travel a whole lot, that kind of thing. Well, this embassy in Baghdad consists of an area the size of the Vatican City. It's 21 buildings. The walls are reinforced 2.5 times their normal standards. And when it's finished, there's going to be room for over 8,000 government officials. It has a gymnasium. It will have the largest swimming pool in the country, a barber, a beauty shop, yoga studios, first-run movie cinema, food court, and commissary. There's a large-scale barracks for troops, a school, probably not for Iraqis, locker rooms, a warehouse, vehicle maintenance garage, 6 apartment buildings with 619 one-bedroom units, and when it's finished, the site will be 2/3 the area of the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Unlike Iraq's infrastructure that I talked about earlier, this construction project is happening right on time. So when you're in Baghdad and you can look across the Tigris River, the Green Zone is surrounded by 15-foot-high concrete blast walls. And you can look up above those walls and there's these towering construction cranes, the totally stereotypical construction crane you'd see at work at a big building in downtown someplace here. There's several of those and they're watching these foreign workers while unemployment is now still well up over 50% in Iraq. And Iraqis are watching these Kuwaitis and Sri Lankans and other slave labor constructing this so-called embassy right in the middle of Baghdad. So you can imagine what that does for their sentiment about the occupation. Another sign of future U.S. plans in Iraq are the bases being built. One of these bases, just to give you an idea, is called Camp Anaconda. It's in Balad, just to the north of Baghdad. And at this air base alone, there's 20,000 soldiers, less than 1,000 of whom ever leave the base. There's 2 base exchanges where they sell the latest high-tech gear, CDs, brand new DVDs. I mean, like, when they come out here, they come out at these bases. One of the managers at one of these base exchanges said he was very proud to announce that they were selling 15 televisions a day to soldiers. There's plans for more air-conditioned troop quarters there, as well as for them to get internet, cable television, and overseas phones. There's thousands of civilian contractors at this one base alone, so many that they have their own little section of apartment buildings on the base that they call KBR land, as in Kellogg, Brown, and Root. This hospital at this one base alone conducts 400 surgeries a month on injured troops. just on this one base. An Air Force official there claimed that his runway was the second busiest in the world. I don't know if that's true. That means this would be the busiest airport in the world behind Chicago. The base has over 250 of its own aircraft, so that means helicopters like Apaches, Chinooks, F-16s, unmanned military surveillance drones. They have lavish meals served from third country nationals. That's what they basically call the slave labor in Iraq, which is primarily composed of people from India, Nepal, and Sri Lanka, basically just because it's better for the profit margin. They serve very lavish meals. They troops eat well now. When they go to Iraq, if they're at a base like this, it used to be they would lose 15 pounds a tour. Now they gain 15 pounds a tour because they'll serve a meal. Maybe it's a turkey dinner. If they don't want that, they can go to the sandwich bar. There's a big salad bar. There's ice cream, you name it. They're definitely being fed well. There's nothing you can be critical of about that aside from what Halliburton's being paid to do it. But if troops don't want those meals, on this base alone, they can instead go to the 24-hour Burger King, the Pizza Hut, the Popeyes, the Subway sandwich shop, and then they can wash that down with a latte from Starbucks. This base also has its own swimming pool, a first-run movie theater, and a Hertz rent-a-car. A Hertz rent-a-car. Probably not to go to Fallujah. Drive around the base. There's a 10-mile-an-hour speed limit, so I guess they're really bored. I don't know. But remember those companies. There's several other gigantic bases like Camp Anaconda. For example, Camp Victory near Baghdad Airport, when it's complete, it's going to be twice the size of Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo, which prior to the bases being built in Iraq was one of the largest overseas bases built by the U.S. since Vietnam. And it's hard to say exactly how many of these bases there are. Speculation has been as low as 10, as high as 16. And it's hard to say because, like Camp Victory near the airport, well, there's also Camp Victory North, and they've grown together. And the bases are so big that you can check all this out online. You can go to the DOD website. And several months ago, there was a photo of a soldier who decided to do his own Ironman triathlon on one of these bases. So an Ironman triathlon means you run a marathon, you bike about 140 miles, and he obviously would spend a lot of time swimming multiple laps in the swimming pool. But there's a picture of him on his bike way out in the middle of nowhere on this base within the walls doing his own Ironman triathlon. And so they're pretty big bases. That's my point. So there's no timetable from the Bush Kabul. Why? Even surprisingly reported by the New York Times on April 1903, this is 10 days after the fall of Baghdad, U.S. military officials said, quote, "There will probably never be an announcement of permanent stationing of troops. Not permanent basing, but permanent access is all that is required," according to the military officials. Note that it is also not forbidden in the Iraqi Constitution would make it illegal for a foreign power, i.e. the United States, to have access to military bases within Iraq. So it's all in the semantics, it's all in what word you want to choose, but it's not permanent bases, it's permanent access. And permanent access is what they have. Another clue as to their future strategy, the 2002 National Security Strategy of the United States. Again, you can look all this up online, and I encourage you to do so. It makes for very interesting reading. Quote, "Our forces will be strong enough to dissuade potential adversaries from pursuing a military buildup in hopes of surpassing or equaling the power of the United States. To accomplish this, the U.S. will require bases and stations within and beyond Western Europe and Northeast Asia." But a segue from that real quick, as most of you may know, there are, admitted by the DOD, 725 U.S. military bases around the globe. In Japan alone, there's 100 U.S. military bases or installations. In South Korea alone, there's another 100 U.S. military bases and installations. U.S. policymakers have replaced the Cold War with the long war for global empire and unchallenged U.S. military hegemony. Here's another clue. There's a military document called Joint Vision 2020, as in the year 2020. Again, I encourage you to Google this and have a read. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's vision here is, quote, dedicated individuals and innovative organizations transforming the joint force of the 21st century to achieve, quote, full spectrum dominance, that's in bold, persuasive in peace, decisive in war, preeminent in any form of conflict. That last bit's in italics. Another very clear clue comes from the Quadrennial Defense Review Report. This one came out this past February 6th. The Quadrennial Defense Review Report. Again, look it up, have a read. There is a stated ambition to fight, quote, multiple overlapping wars and to, quote, ensure that all major and emerging powers are integrated as constructive actors and stakeholders into the international system. I think this one's pretty telling. I like to read it twice. There is a stated ambition to fight multiple overlapping wars and to ensure that all major and emerging powers are integrated as constructive actors and stakeholders into the international system. The report goes on to say that the U.S. will, quote, also seek to ensure that no foreign power can dictate terms of regional or global security. It will attempt to dissuade any military competitor from developing disruptive or other capabilities that could enable regional hegemony or hostile action against the U.S. or other friendly countries, and it will seek to deter aggression or coercion. Should deterrence fail, the U.S. will deny a hostile power its strategic and operational objectives. So again, after hearing these military documents and the stated policy of the United States, their foreign policy, their military policy, let's hear that quote from General Pace again. I'd say they are going well. I wouldn't put a great big smiley face on it, but I would say they're going very, very well from everything you look at. So as citizens of the empire, I think that it's long past time, and now especially with what Israel's doing in southern Lebanon, that each of us decide what we can live with. Can we sleep at night knowing that atrocities are being carried out in our names in Iraq, now in southern Lebanon, soon probably to be Syria and then Iran, funded by our tax dollars? If not, then what lengths are we willing to go to stop this? Thanks. Thanks very much. So I intentionally left plenty of time so that we could talk more about Iraq or I just came back two nights ago. I got in from Damascus. I spent about 2 weeks reporting from Syria and about 2 weeks reporting from Beirut. So I'm more than happy to talk about that situation as well and want to. So we'll go ahead and open it up for questions.
Sorry, I have two questions. The first is I'm wondering what's going on in Gaza, in Palestine. I'm hearing like nothing as we get horrific reports of what's going on in Lebanon. Do you have any current information about what's going on there?
Yeah, a bit. I have a friend that just came back from Palestine, and basically it's kind of the same thing that's happening in Palestine as with Iraq, that now everything's about Lebanon and Israel, so this other stuff doesn't exist. It's not going on. And really, even when I flew back from Jordan, I flew Royal Jordanian from Amman to Chicago, and I sat by a Jordanian man and then also sat near a man from Ramallah. And he said, you wouldn't imagine what's going on now. It's worse than ever before. The Israeli military is regularly now carrying out raids and/or airstrikes in Gaza and killing people, killing innocent people, detaining more people. They already have at least 9,000 Palestinians or southern Lebanese in their jails. most of whom are civilians, just like in U.S. jails in Iraq. But they've basically used the media attention being diverted to southern Lebanon and northern Israel to as a carte blanche to do whatever they want in the occupied territories.
So with all this, my ultimate question is, what can we do? I don't understand what it would take to get U.S. citizens to, like, refuse en masse to stop paying taxes. I mean, what can we do?
My favorite question. I hate that question. I don't have a specific answer, and plus I think it'd be really disrespectful if I did. For me, I got pissed off enough. I decided, well, information control, I'm a writer. That's how they're getting away with it, is information control, using these outlets. So I'll go, except Jazeera. So I'll go over there and cover it myself. And I think it's just time that each person looks really deep inside yourself and decide, what am I willing to do? Because it's really amazing to me, and it's always a massive culture shock. It's like I'm stepping back into the Matrix or to Disneyland to come back to the U.S. after being over in the Middle East and watching outlets like Al Jazeera or other outlets over there out of Lebanon or in Syria that are showing what happens when the bombs drop. They're showing them digging babies out of the rubble in Kana after the Israelis bombed this place. They're showing body parts. They're showing people wounded in hospitals. They're really showing what's going on. They're showing this total war of aggression, this total collective punishment against all of the country of Lebanon. They're reporting that even now in the north, the Israeli military today over there just dropped leaflets as far north as Tripoli, saying any vehicle, especially any truck on the coastal road, is a legitimate target. So they're showing that. And the problem is over here is I think people don't think that they're being directly affected by this. And what I spoke about earlier just before this workshop at the plenary was I really want to just bring it home that I can't tell people what to do or make suggestions, but I want to bring home the urgency of the situation, that the Middle East is in flames. It's going to get worse. There's not going to be an end to this Israeli war against Lebanon. This is going to expand. This is going to bring Syria and Iran into this. This is exactly what they want. They want to be able to blame Iran so they can conduct massive airstrikes against the country. And that's like a step away from World War III. And we're talking about nuclear weapons. And none of this is being covered by any of these so-called news organizations. And so I come back and tell people and just really want to convey this sense of urgency that this is where we're at. They're not going to just go and start total war in the Middle East and redraw the lines and then take the oil and live happily ever after. They're going to redraw the lines and there's going to be total war. And Russia and China will get involved. And that's what's happening right now in the Middle East, and Lebanon is the first step in that. And the next step is Syria. That means Iran, and then it's one more step. And that's where we're at. And I think that I don't know how much more clear I can make it that if you've thought about doing something but haven't done it because it's inconvenient or it's too big of a risk, now's the time. I feel like we all need to be behaving like the Mike Furners and be at home on house arrest, because that guy has done literally everything he could possibly think. He's starved himself. He's been arrested so many times. He writes. He doesn't shut up. He doesn't stop. That's what we all need to be doing. And if we're not doing stuff to that level, then we're just clearly not doing enough. So that's my short answer. Myself included.
Regarding the allegations of sectarian violence and civil war in Iraq, I was wondering if you could offer your thoughts regarding the quota system in the Constitution that specifically targets or specifically requires people to come from various sectarian groups, and the use of the deputy system for the Prime Minister, the Speaker of the House, and the President. And perhaps even the 110,000 man militia that's funded by the DOD in Iraq. Just in order to provide a picture on sectarian violence in Iraq?
Yeah, no, that's a really good and a really important question. And in fact, I want to start answering this question about civil war and the sectarianism in the background by going back again to my friend from Bakuba that I just was talking with in Damascus a couple of days ago. He came out and we spent a few days together. And he's a speaker at a mosque in Bakuba for Friday prayers. So he goes up and leads prayers. And he told me that in Bakuba, 1 month into the occupation, that the U.S. military asked all the religious people of the city. And Bakuba is a very mixed city. It's basically half Shia and half Sunni. And there's Sunni mosques and Shia mosques there, and they're mixed, and they pray at each other's mosques. And he said that he was there, and a U.S. military commander came in and said, okay, which of you are Shia and which of you are Sunni? We basically want Sunni over here and Shia over here. And everyone just looked at each other. They're like, this is, you know, we don't refer to ourselves as that. But he said, no, really, I want you to split up. And then we're going to talk to you in that way. And my friend, the Sheikh, he said, you know, no one can tell me this didn't happen. I was there. I am a Sunni. I had to go over here. And that started 1 month into the occupation. And then that type of behavior, you know, immediately we started hearing propaganda about Shia, Sunni, Kurd, Shia, Sunni, Kurd, civil war, civil war, civil war. And then we look at the, exactly as you said, the structure of the parliament in Iraq, where, let's be real clear, the Iraqi constitution was written in English and translated into Arabic, okay? Every ministry in Iraq has a U.S. advisor serving five-year terms. No ministry in Iraq is going to do anything on their own. The government's never going to ask for them to leave. And the ministry is so, or the entire government, I should say, is situated exactly as you said, that there's, okay, based on this population statistics, where again, it's another one of these, when was the last census? I interviewed, well, I'll get back to that, but there's basically going to be, okay, this many Shia, this many Sunni, this many Kurds. So that it's structured like the Lebanese government, where the Lebanese government, based on a 1932 census, you know, the prime minister is always going to be this sect, the president's always going to be this sect, and then there's going to be this many parliament members, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why the Christians will always have a majority in the Lebanese government, because they won't do another census, because if they know if they do another one, they'll lose power. And it's the same thing it's the same type of parliament structure in Iraq, where it is basically set up to naturally divide people along sectarian or ethnic lines. So all the Kurds are going to vote for Talabani. You know, all the Shia are going to vote for whoever the highest Shia is in there. I mean, it naturally is set up to divide the people. And then the other thing is it's a completely impotent government, because they can't pass anything unless it's a two-third majority. So let's apply that to our own government. How many bills would pass if they required a two-thirds majority? I mean, half the time it's 51 to 49. You know, but that's the structure, and it's all set up by the U.S. government. It's set up to be impotent. It's set up to fail. It's set up to generate and facilitate sectarian tensions and civil war. And then if we talk about black operations, the bombing of the mosque in Samarra in February of this year was definitely a black operation. We've had numerous instances, well documented. I think the best known instance of black operations, and you know, so many of you are military, you understand this is what goes on. Of course, the general public thinks it's a conspiracy theory, but just look what happened down in Basra a good ways back, when two undercover British SAS guys were caught in a car full of explosives, wearing dashes, keffiyeh, trying to fit in, and then they were detained by Sadr's militia and accused of trying to plant bombs at mosque and cause sectarian civil war. But then before they could try them, the British military raised the jail and took their guys out. Now they're doing their patrols down there by helicopter, but that's beside the point. But the point is that without a doubt, civil war has been going on since, I think at the latest it started in January 05, right before the elections. And I think you could easily argue that it started before that. And now it's full on. Sectarian cleansing, ethnic cleansing, neighborhoods, militias are setting up checkpoints. And this is why my friends are leaving. They said, you know, if you go to a checkpoint and you're a Sunni and it's a Shia checkpoint, that's it. That's it. My friend from Bakuba, he's a religious scholar, so he knows Shia Islam as well as he knows Sunni Islam. He has talks that he's written up about Shia imams and you know, Ali and this sort of thing, so that if he gets pulled over at a Shia checkpoint, he can pull out these and say, yeah, well, I'm Shia, and let me tell you all about this. So they'll ask him questions, and he can get by and not get killed. I mean, that's it. It's full-on civil war. So that kind of blows the whole argument, which the Cheney administration used for a while, well, we have to stay in Iraq to prevent civil war. Well, civil war has been going on for a long time, and it's by their own doing, for sure. Because you can't justify to continue the occupation if there's peace. It's just that simple.
When I first got over to Kuwait before we rolled north, so this is late 2004, right before the elections, 2005, there was a feeling in the air among the American military. I didn't see any reports. It was never a briefing. But everyone on the ground seemed to feel that by early 2006, we'd either be in Damascus or in Tehran. We were all braced for an expansion of the war. Of course, the resistance, the insurgency was picking up by that time, and things changed. But when this whole thing broke out in Israel and Lebanon, and we started rattling the sabers about Iran, all of this came back to me, that this doesn't seem unplanned. This doesn't seem, you know, just events getting out of control. I've never been a conspiracy person, but from what I experienced while I was over there, it seems that there are larger plans afoot here. And I was wondering if you have any sense of this, and more specifically, do you have any kind of information that might back this idea up?
Well, again, aside from the documents I just stated, and you know, I think the clearest thing I've seen that is basically the admittance of this is that line that I read of the stated goal to fight multiple overlapping wars. That's their policy. It's not to go in and take a country and have a regime change. It's to fight multiple overlapping wars, and that's what we got two now going. I think we should say three, because Israel wouldn't and couldn't be doing what they're doing right now in southern Lebanon without the unbridled support politically, economically, Apaches, F-16s, bombs, white phosphorus, cluster bombs. They couldn't do any of that without the U.S. I mean, this is a proxy military, basically, for the U.S., but of course the interests served are both. But I think really to answer your question, if we look at the Project for the New American Century, they state very clear the need to control Middle East oil reserves. And then we look at some of the reporting of Cy Hirsch, for example, who said that it's basically people in the Bush administration, whistleblowers have told him that Bush has taken it upon himself that he has this messianic vision that he will have regime change in Iran before the end of his term. And I think that, you know, Syria right now is the linchpin, that once Syria gets involved, then Iran is involved by default with their pact. And I think that that's what we have to look to, that there's enough people, whistleblowers that have come out of this administration that Cy Hirsch alone has reported on that have said very clearly, this is what they want to do. They want control of Iranian oil. And really, Iran is the last thing where we look at Israel's interests and we look at the U.S., and the U.S.'s are more corporate, and Israel's, while they're corporate, they're also the Zionists running the show. Basically, they want to take out any threat to their existence, and right now Iran is the biggest threat, and they want to hit Iran, and I think that the U.S. will eventually hit Iran, which the U.S., I think, a large reason of the invasion of Iraq was, I think, aside from the corporate interests and natural resources, without a doubt, 50% of that was to help the Israeli policy, because Iraq was the biggest threat. Saddam Hussein at the time was the biggest threat. But I think all of these combined, I'm sorry if I can't be more specific or clear, but I think all of those combined are what makes me feel certain that without massive resistance here at home, that these people are not going to stop, and they certainly are going to be involved in attacking Iran, I think, maximum within a year.
Thanks for coming. Lyndon Johnson famously said, when I lost Cronkite, I lost the country. and we are now presented with this hall of shame. What's the big difference? Why during the Vietnam era was the press so interested in digging in and finding out and reporting to the public? To what do you attribute that big switch in the way the press operates?
Well, first, I don't think we should totally glorify the media in Vietnam, because when that war started, and until it really, really started to go south, the media was pretty darn on board and waving the war flags, and it wasn't, it was kind of like poll-driven politics. It wasn't until the administrations then and started to come under fire for it when tens of thousands of people were being killed, Americans, then the media really changed and really started to do their job. But I think basically it's corporate control of the media. The short answer is that when you have NBC, you know, the National Broadcast Corporation, a national television network owned by General Electric, one of the largest weapons manufacturers on the planet, it's not good for GE's business to have a TV station showing blown up body parts from their product. It's just not good for business. And then we talk about the fact that it used to be that journalists would go out and find the news and then come back to their editor and say, look, you know, this is what's going on. This is what I just saw in Kana. And then work out how they want to write the story with the editor. Now that's changed. Since it's corporate-owned media, it's a business. So, okay, what's selling? Well, people want to hear about Britney Spears' baby, or they want to hear about this affair or that or whatever other bullshit. Instead, they're given their marching orders. And Fox is really the prime example where literally it's very well documented. They have memos daily, like, this is what you're going to report. This is the news. So corporate is telling journalists what the news is. Instead of us on the street going out and seeing it with our own eyes, saying, no, this is the news. And every one of those, with a few reporters' exceptions and maybe a few of those outlets, that's how they operate. They're a business. They're corporate-owned. It's not about information. It's not about free speech. It's not about, you know, the commons, the airways belonging to us. They belong to the corporations now, and that's the problem. That's why, you know, independent media is it. Alternative media, democracy now, that's it. I mean, that's what we have to support, and that's what we have left in this country. All of these, accepting Al Jazeera, are guilty without a doubt in aiding and abetting in war crimes. They're cheerleaders for war. NPR, National Pentagon Radio, go on down the list. I mean, it's really a shame, and it's a disgrace. And I don't see how any of the people working for those outlets can look themselves in the mirror. But that's basically it. It's corporate ownership is the problem.
A different quick and dirty. My son was a two-tour gun truck CO in Iraq. They had the first gun truck company, as a matter of fact. And for 3 years now, I've heard from him and his fellow soldiers that they had very little contact at all with the Iraqis. I mean, outside the wire, virtually nothing. I'm wondering, what do your friends think, or do you have any idea what the friends you mentioned, what do they think of the troops? I can imagine what the rest of the country feels like, but as far as your friends on a personal level, and have you had any indication that the troops feel differently outside of some of the polls we've had that they want to get out there, that they're not behind it?
No, most Iraqis, I mean, it depends where you go. And you know, in places like Fallujah, they don't differentiate between the troops and the government and the American people. The anti-American sentiment is so high that they hate them all. But then others, like my two friends I just met with, they say, hey, we know that most of these guys are the poor and the people that joined because they were lied to and thought they could get an education and were told they'd never have to see combat and told they sure as hell would never have to go to a place like Iraq. So they know, they understand, hey, they're screwed as much as we're screwed. They don't want to be here. We know their morale sucks. We see their faces. They're scared to death. They're miserable. You know, we know they're getting bombed every day. So most people, I think, make that distinction. But of course, you know, most people there still favor an immediate withdrawal. But that point you mentioned, that early on in the occupation, there was more interaction. There was still, I think most soldiers still believed in this hearts and minds thing. And that's gone. It's survival now. That's why it's shoot first, ask questions later. And, you know, it's like there's us and then there's the Rockies and that's it. You know, so there is no more interaction, and that's a huge problem.
I would ask you to address the connection between the military-industrial complex's need for to an enemy and therefore to smash the smithereens and other countries' infrastructure, and the benefit the corporations, the multinational corporations, get from a Bush administration that puts the building of the smashed parts of a country to up for bid and hires mercenary soldiers to go in. Would you address the connection between the use of mercenary soldiers to protect these corporations that obviously have not the interests of the country they are working on?
Well, Iraq is without a doubt the prime example of that, where it's so clear that these contracts, many of them were signed before the bombs started falling on Baghdad. Halliburton, KBR, Bechtel, on down the list, Bearing Point. And clearly they have, the mercenary companies, for example, that they're basically private militias that are hired by Halliburton to protect their workers in Iraq, and then those that do actually go out and engage in some construction projects. And then the other part, like the Israeli war, without a doubt, the weapons manufacturers, I mean, the vast majority of these weapons used, the Apaches, the F-16s, the bombs they're dropping, they're all U.S. supplied. The U.S. gives over $2 billion in aid a year to Israel. Since the early 70s, Israel's been the largest benefactor of U.S. foreign aid anywhere on the planet every year since then. And that's why. So, yeah, the more bombs that drop, bomb the whole country, bomb it all again. I mean, it's just bottom line business. The more bombs that explode, the more they have to make, and then guaranteeing more war. You know, this is why we were warned ages ago by Eisenhower, I believe it was, of, you know, beware the military-industrial complex. And, you know, that wasn't heeded. That was adopted, rather, as policy by Reagan, and this is the end result. And that's what we have right now going on.
My question is, you spent a lot of time in Iraq. Do you worry about being exposed to depleted uranium yourself? And did you see a lot of birth defects in Iraq because of our use of unsafe weapons?
Yeah, I did worry about that, and I did just get checked out, actually. I got blood tests, and I'm okay, so I feel really lucky. But without a doubt, there's massive, massive birth defects throughout Iraq, especially southern Iraq. But now in Baghdad, breast cancer is really, really prevalent, and most of the Iraqi doctors I talked to about this, and you can look up a lot of these photos online, it's absolute horrendous, babies being born with two heads or no spines. I mean, just horrible, horrible birth defects. So, yeah, without a doubt, there's massive, massive incidence of skyrocketing cancer rates in Iraq as a result of most doctors in Iraq believe it's a direct result of the use of DU. So I just got told I'm out of time, so I've got to wrap it up. Thanks, everybody, a whole lot for coming. I'll come ask you.
Colombia and in the Philippines, we have these additional waters.